introduce the EduCommons, and next will be another distinguished speaker, Stephen Downs, who fly for 30 hours from Canada, Toronto, am I right?
Moncton.
Oh, Moncton, to support us in keeping the trend of e-learning and the trend of maybe even more about Web 2.0. So let me tell you a short story. I think I'll tell a story in Chinese. 2004年的时候我们自己在进行的开放式课程计划，那个时候在国际间当然还没有任何人知道。 Stephen Downs 是全世界第一个在他的blog上面写到关于我们故事的，所以你可以知道这件事情对于我们来讲是一个非常有趣的经验，是既然有人可以涉猎这么多的资料到在台湾的一个e-learning计划，他可以 及时的 real time 把它写在他的 blog 上面，然后让全世界的其他读者看到。我刚说过，他每天的读者的数量，可能都有20万人以上，甚至可能到10几万人，包括 newspaper 的阅读的数量。所以，哇，you're quick。所以，我想等一下他所提到的趋势，应该会是相对来说，他所看到在涉猎的这么多的 内容在全世界各地演讲之后所看到的一个新的趋势，所以各位等一下，如果你看到任何地方有任何的好奇的地方，请不要忘记跟他互动。 So let's welcome Stephen Downs.
Well, hello everyone, and thank you very much, Luke, for your wonderful introduction, and thank.
Well, everyone knows Chinese now.
And thank you, everybody, for coming here on a Monday morning. I very much appreciate it, and I appreciate the time that you've taken to come to this presentation. As Luke maybe said, I'm sort of filling in, so my talk may be a bit bumpy, but I'm sure you'll bear with me, and we'll go through it without difficulties. Luke, how much time am I working with, please?
It's kind of a three. You've got 1 hour, but you can spend 30 minutes talk or 20 minutes interaction or 40 minutes, 10 minutes. That's okay for you. But allow us to check the microphone. It seems that it did not pick your sound.
Oh, yeah. It's doing... Hello?
No.
Nope, we got nothing.
No.
So, oh, there we go. Okay, somebody is in the back. But I can't see them, so I don't know who it is. So I don't know who to make faces at. What I want to talk today about, I'm going to be a bit introductory, and then I'm going to be a bit forward-looking. So you get a bit of both worlds. I'm going to talk about open educational resources. I'll talk a little bit about what they are and a bit about some of the challenges. And then, as the title suggests, I'll move into talking about something called a personal learning environment. And this is something that you may not have heard about, but this is something that is coming along that will become more common, more widely used for the distribution of open educational resources. So that's the plan in overview. I hope that's okay, Luke. It's what I came up with on the airplane. And I'm also speaking on Wednesday. On Wednesday, I'll talk about Web 2.0 more specifically and talk about some of the technologies, and I'll show you some pictures from Canada. Because I can. I want to talk for a moment about what an open educational resource is, because it is very common to simply start talking about them without talking about what they are. And at heart, what an open educational resource is, and this includes open courseware, is a resource that is available at no cost to the learner. So there's no transfer of money involved. And also, it's often thought of as being a bit broader than that. Not simply that you do not have to pay money, but also that you do not have to take up a subscription to something, or you do not have to pay tuition fees at a university, or you do not have to register and put your name and your email and your blood type in, and or you have no obligations, you're not required to trade something back. The concept of open courseware is that you have free access to this material without conditions. There are no requirements for you to do things. Now, there are typically, though, some restrictions. And in John's talk, there was some mention of Creative Commons. And Creative Commons is an example of some of the restrictions that might apply. For example, if you use some open courseware, you might be required to give credit to the author of that material. That's known as attribution. Or, for example, you might be required to use it only for non-commercial purposes. So you cannot turn around and start charging money for open courseware. To me, that seems very reasonable. Also, the idea of open courseware is that it gives you freedoms, in it, not just to view and to look at the material, but also to make copies of the material for other people, to modify the material, to make changes, to adapt it to your own local circumstances, and, of course, to redistribute either the copied material or the material that you've made changes to. So it's not just something that they put up there, and yeah, you're allowed to read it, and that's it. Open courseware is about actually giving you the material so that you can do what you want with it. And that's a very important component of it. How are we doing so far? Excellent. I got one thumbs up. That's one more thumbs up than I'm used to. Typically, when we talk about open courseware, where we talk about open educational resources, we are talking mostly about courseware, about learning materials. But open educational resources can often refer to many more things. They can refer not simply to the content that you would use in learning, but to the tools and the software that you would use to produce more learning materials. The EduCommons, for example, is a good example of open educational resources. It's a tool that allows you to put open courses online. And also, open educational resources includes capacity building. It includes, for example, materials and supports to help teachers learn how to teach better. So it might include online counseling service and online support and things like that. So it's not just content. It's the whole range of resources that you might need to support learning. Now, one of the big debates, and I'm sure if David Wiley were here, he would talk about this a bit, and I'm sure John may want to come back to it a bit, is the issue of sustainability. And this really concerns organizations like OECD, and UNICEF, and others of other international bodies. Because when they look at open educational resources, and they're looking at providing resources for, I don't know, 3 or 4 billion people around the world, the matter of cost becomes a matter of some concern. The production of open educational resources costs money. MIT OpenCourseWare, for example, cost millions of dollars. Some of that was in doing things like clearing copyright. Other costs include hosting costs, internet costs for the bandwidth, server costs, staff costs for people to create these resources. So there's always, when we talk about open educational resources, a lot of talk about sustainability. And usually, when people talk about sustainability, they talk about it from the provider perspective. How much does it cost for the provider to create resources? How much does it cost for the provider to put resources online? And so what happens, and I think this is an important point, is that when people start talking about the cost of open courseware or open educational resources. They think about it from their existing perspective as providers. If they're a publisher, for example, they say, well, it cost me so much money to publish a book, so it would cost that same amount of money to publish a book for free. So they have that one model in mind. At this juncture, though, when we're looking at providing resources for free, we need to ask whether there are other models for distributing open educational resources. Do we have to work with this provider-consumer model? Well, as I say, we have to think about much more than just the amount of money that is spent, because we need to think about what kind of resources we're putting out there as well. It doesn't matter how much a resource costs if nobody can use it. So part of the cost is going to be the cost of making sure that people can access it, that people can use it. One of the questions we ask, for example, is how durable it is. How long will the resource last? If we produce something cheaply, it might only last for a short while. If we produce something more expensive, it might last longer. But we want to ask questions like, if we're going to spend $1 million on this resource and it's only going to last 3 months, is that a good investment? We also want to be sure that it's usable and accessible to the widest number of people. The more people that can use a resource, the better it is as far as cost is concerned. On the other hand, if we produce a resource that can only be used by a few people, that resource is more expensive. Similarly, because they are intended to be learning resources, we want them to be effective. We want them to actually help people learn. It would be like if you invite a speaker here from Canada, you can invite a good speaker or you can invite a bad speaker. The good speaker is money well spent. The bad speaker, well, is money wasted, right? So if the money is well spent, that's effective, that's efficient, that's thinking about cost. But if the money is wasted, then that is a more expensive way because you'll need more and more speakers. I talked a bit about the traditional model of publishing, of producing these resources, of covering these costs. The traditional way publishing works is that you set up a company and you hire a bunch of people. And these people will create content for you. They'll write the text, they'll draw the images, they'll create the animations, they'll create the programs and all the things that you need to do in order to produce an educational resource. This is why it can be very expensive. If you look at an organization like MIT, for example, they have to hire people and set up, and I actually went and visited their office, and they have a real nice big office with, you know, offices and tables and chairs. They have to hire people to produce all of these resources. Every time you hire a person to do some part of the production of an open educational resource, that makes the resource more expensive. And so the more people you need to produce the resource, the more sustainability becomes an issue. If you always have to be bringing people in to be producing these resources, then it gets harder and harder to provide free educational resources. Now, a lot of organizations have looked at it a bit differently, and they've said, well, we can't afford to hire people because we don't have enough money. We're not MIT. And so they use volunteers. And so they bring in volunteers, but even that raises some questions, doesn't it? If you bring in a volunteer, the first question that you ask is, why are you here? I've worked with volunteers, you see. And volunteers have many motivations, have many reasons for coming to do work for you for free. So you ask them why they're here. Different volunteers have different motivations, and it becomes a challenge for the organizer to match those motivations with the tasks. Right, Luke?
Yes. And I have to ask the previous question. I think the money is wisely spent to invite you to fly from Canada in the speech. Isn't that good?
I wanted to leave that open, and then I was going to pass around a hat at the end. There are, in fact, many different ways of creating volunteer organizations. Some organizations rely on individual members contributing to a community. Open source software is like this, where you'll have a project and a community develops around that project, like, say, MySQL or the Apache web server or Firefox, and then individuals contribute to that deliberately to that organization. Another model is a model like Slashdot or eBay or these other content sites where you have an online site and people come and they do things and they're not contributing so much to the project, but their contributions result as a result of their activities. It's kind of an odd thing to explain, but basically what happens is, like on Slashdot, people go to Slashdot and they make comments. They make comments because they want their opinion to be heard. But the result is all the different people making comments produces, as a result, a community. It's sort of almost like an accidental community. And then finally, there is the model, and I'm going to spend some time on this third model, which takes apart this whole idea of producers and consumers and merges the two roles together. Right now, when we think of online content, we think one person produces it and then another person consumes it. Producer-consumer. So the publisher produces, the student consumes. But in this new model, what happens is you merge those two roles. Sometimes it's called the prosumer model, where the consumer of the resource is also the producer of the resource. The consumer does the production. And you might think, well, how can that happen? That's like the student being the teacher. But that is exactly what happens. As a result of people working together in a community, they are able to produce the resources. Thank you very much. I will say, I am not used to the climate here. It's a little warmer than in Canada. There are mountains out there without snow on them. Now, why are these models important? The models are important because the type of producer of the content changes the type of content that you get. If you think about it, if the producer of some sort of content is a university, then you are probably going to get a university course. You would not expect a university to produce a comic book. On the other hand, if the producer of a resource is a publisher, then you'll probably get a book or a magazine or a journal. If the producer is a government, then you'll get something like an institution or a government support site or resources or things like that. So, depending on the model that you have, that is going to change the resource that you have. Now, I've picked some fairly obvious examples here, but, you know, this goes right the way through. If you think of all the different kinds of producers you can have, you're going to get a wide range of different kinds of resources. Now me, if I produce a resource, think about what I would produce. Well, it would be in English. It would be written from a Canadian perspective. It would reflect certain attitudes and values that I have. Now think about what the resource would look like if you produced it. Much less likely to be in English. Probably not from a Canadian perspective. And it will reflect your different values, your different background, your different beliefs, right? So that's why it's important when we talk about collapsing the consumer-producer model, what we are doing is changing the content of the resource. The educational resource used to have the content that the producer wanted. It used to reflect the values of the producer. But now when the consumer, when the student, when the learner produces the resource reflects the values of the learner more than the values of the producer. And you can see how that would change the resource and why that change might be important in learning. We looked at sustainability again. The sustainability of learning resources. One of the things that producers of learning resources have learned over the years is that if you produce a resource here and you use it here, you have to adapt it. You have to change it. That process is known as localization. And so one of the expenses involved is the localization of learning materials. And Lucifer, again, will be able to tell you about that. One of the things... Oh, you don't have to actually tell them, though.
No, I just sit back and ask, well, I listen to your orders.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize I had so much control.
Well, if you say jump, I ask you how high.
Jump. Just testing. Turn around in circles. Gee, this is fun. Let's stop the talk. I'll just make Luke do funny things. What Luke would tell you is resources produced by MIT OpenCourseWare are produced in English, of course, because they're produced in the United States. And so one of the major localization things that needs to be done is their translation here into Chinese and into other languages in other jurisdictions. That's just one type of localization, though. I wanted to study Spanish recently because I went on a trip to Colombia, which is really a wonderful place, but they don't speak English there, so I need to learn Spanish. So I went to the store and I bought a CD, Learn Spanish. And I put the CD in my computer and they give me a choice. I can use British English or American English. So I put in, I choose British English and I go, hello, how are you doing? And I don't know, that's not actually a very good British accent. But that won't work. And so I choose American. I go, hiya, how you doing? I'm from Canada. I'm not used to that kind of intensity. Especially first thing on a Monday morning. Sorry, John. But it's just sort of like... localization isn't just language. It's how you talk, the way you talk, the way you express yourself, the sorts of background assumptions that you make. All of these things are involved in localization, and it's a lot harder than you might imagine to think about the different things. In fact, it's so hard that, in my opinion, you can't actually define a process. I have an example I use sometimes in a different context, but it works here. I ask people to think of the word Paris. And I'll try it here. It's an English word, but that's okay. I'll try it here. Everybody here, think of the word Paris. Are you thinking of the word? If you're not thinking of the word, start now. Okay. How many of you thought of the city, Paris, in France? Just raise your hands if you thought of that city. A few people. How many of you thought of Paris Hilton? More people, including a very enthusiastic. When I think of the word Paris, I think of plaster of Paris, which is used for making figures and, well, plaster things. The point here is, when I say the word Paris, different people think of different things. So if I'm going to use the word Paris in a resource, it's going to mean something different to different people. So it's very hard for a producer to actually understand all the different ways people are going to react when the producer uses the word Paris. It's impossible to predict that. And Paris is a simple word, right? It's not complicated. It's not an expression. I don't know how to go back. John, how do I back up?
Nice
space. Okay. Okay, good. New computer. I'm still not used to using a Macintosh computer to do my presentations. I usually used a PC, but I swore up and down I would never, ever use Microsoft Vista. And so I'm trying out this Macintosh, and it's a beautiful computer. I love the computer, but it has its quirks. It's sort of like localizing computers. So all of this leads to a very powerful reason to rethink the provider-consumer relationship. And not just in the publication of materials, but in the design and organization of learning itself. And it gives it, you know, I put the phrase here, cultural imperialism, and that's a bit of a cliche. And so I don't mean something so strong. I get complaints about, spreading the English culture around the world and being a cultural imperialist. And I said, what? I'm from Canada. We don't imperialize anything. But people don't understand that. But even when I come to speak, right, I'm projecting not just the content, but my culture and my values. And I think that's good, but only if it's balanced, so that I project my content, you project yours. But that means we need to change the relationship so that there's more than one producer, so that I produce and you produce and you produce and you produce, and that way everybody gets to project their values and it becomes much more equal. So, and this is your challenge for this conference. We need to think about open educational resources from the perspective of the user and the user's community, and not simply from the point of view of the provider. And that's a very hard challenge, because we always think about providing them. But we need to think about the user, and not just what the user needs, right? Not just a survey of what they need, but rather what the user would produce if the user were producing educational resources, and how to allow the user to produce those resources, to produce the resources that will help them learn. In the traditional way of producing educational resources, there's a very specific process that we go through, and you'll probably see descriptions of that process this week, where you design the resource, you run some pilot studies, and maybe you evaluate the resource. You do something like peer review. There's a project in the United States called Merlot, I don't know exactly what it stands for, but basically it's a repository of online educational resources. And what they do is they treat those resources as though they were academic publications. And so a professor, and it's always a professor, writes the resource, they create the resource, and then they submit it, and then it goes for a peer review. And the problem with Merlot is the peer review process is very slow. It creates a bottleneck. It means that only a few resources can be produced. We need to rethink this model of production. We need to rethink how it is that we produce these resources and to move away from this publishing model. The publishing model is centralized. You send things to a publisher, and the publisher will manage the production and the evaluation and all of that. And we need to get away from that centralized model. And we need to rethink the size of the resources that we produce. People are talking, even this week, about courses. And we need to ask, well, do we want to be producing entire courses? Will that be the best kind of material for a local user? What we need to think about is not just the mechanism of production, not just the steps that you go through, not just the technology that is used, but the model of production, the very idea of how these resources are produced. Existing structures depend on centralized management, one person in charge, centralized funding, big donations from big organizations to big organizations, to outcomes and the whole range of things. But I think that we'll find that these management structures are often barriers to the production and distribution of open learning resources. There was a recent report from the OECD called Giving Knowledge for Free. And, you know, it bothered me because I participated in the putting together of that report. I talked about community-based production models, and it seemed to me that the authors of that report, the final authors, missed the point entirely. As long as we think of educational resources as something that we create and then give to people, like some kind of charity, it's always going to cost money, and it's never going to be sustainable. We have to stop thinking of resources as something that we give, but rather that something that all of us together as a community produce. How's my time, Luke?
You've got 10 minutes left, and I think you can explain what is OECD.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. OECD stands for... What does it stand for? Organization of Economic... No. Basically what OECD...
Cooperation and Development.
Thank you. Which is... And it's funny because I don't remember the exact meaning of the words, because the meaning of the words isn't really reflective of the organization. Basically what OECD is an organization of economically developed countries, and they get together and talk about how to keep economic development, keep themselves economically developed. They talk about world economic production and things like that. How's that? All right. I'm not going to get myself into trouble by describing the organization further. The main point is OECD is the collection of countries that have a lot of industrial power and a lot of resources. In other words, generally Europe, North America, Japan, the rich countries of the world. So the new model, instead of producing resources, the model is to produce the mechanisms needed to help people produce resources. And this is even beginning to show up in the commercial sphere. I hear Ellen Wagner from Adobe saying things like, we want to be the tool maker, not the content producer. And Google is getting into these open source tools, things like Google Reader, or it used to be called Writely, but I forget what it is now, Google Word or something. Basically, today, open educational resources are more about giving people the means to create resources and then stepping out of the way and allowing them to do it. That's why the new tools are really important. The new software applications that are coming online that people can use. I made this on the airplane. Oh man, I was tired. The new tools produce a model of e-learning that I called e-learning 2.0. And the idea of e-learning 2.0 is that we think of learning resources not as something that transmit information, not as something that we consume, but rather as things that we work with, that we do things with. We think of a book or a video or something like that as though it were a word in a vocabulary. And we receive that and we start playing with it, shaping it, and making it our own. And that's what these Web 2.0 tools allow you to do. These tools allow you to take resources and to reshape them, to remix them, to re-aggregate them, to make them your own. And then that way you produce your learning resource. So how does that work? Well, one thing we need is the actual place where we make things, the place where we create content. So we have things like blogging software engines or e-portfolio engines like ELGG. Or even places where we can create and store video. I could create a video and store it right here now in front of you. I won't because I don't have time. But I could. I could just record it and then upload it to YouTube. And I'm done. I've created a resource. I'm creating a resource right now, in fact. What I have here is an iRiver. As you can see, it's almost finished its life. But it still works. And I'm recording this talk and the other talks, and then I'll take those talks and I'll upload them onto the internet. And that's producing an open educational resource. How much is this costing me? Almost nothing. Part of Web 2.0 is that we work not just alone, but we work together. We work in groups or in networks. So there are ways that we can create materials collaboratively using things like wikis, and you'll hear a lot more about wikis over the next few days. I want to talk, for example, about the South African educational curriculum, which has been taken and put on a wiki. And what putting it on a wiki does is it allows anybody who reads that wiki to edit the content of that page. So the wiki is not just a reading tool, it's a writing tool, and it allows everybody working on that page to write on that page. There are collaborative bookmarking applications like Furl and Delicious and others where people get together in groups and exchange locations of websites. Or there are applications that allow people to write together. Once you have all of this content, the next step is to have tools to gather the content together. These are called aggregators. And what an aggregator will do is pull content from different locations across the internet. So we have a whole bunch of tools. Aggregate This, Metaxu Cafe, Google Reader isn't on there, but that's one that I use. EduRSS is a tool that I developed. And then finally, once you've aggregated these things together, you need a way of displaying them. What's been developed more recently online is something called the web top. A web top is a computer application that displays all the things that you've brought together. Facebook might be thought of as a web top. One that you want to look at is called PageFlakes. PageFlakes, if you go to PageFlakes, you can create a desktop with all the different feeds from different locations, content that you bring in from different websites. This whole picture together creates something that I've called learning networks. The idea here now is that you have content being produced in many different places and then being brought together. But it's brought together, it's brought together, it's brought together. It creates this whole network of content. That's what moves us from the learning management system to the personal learning environment. In the learning management system, all the content is in one place. It's created there, it's stored there. You have to go to the content. In the personal learning environment, the content is spread all over the internet. And you bring it, you collect it, and you display it in your one location. The content comes to you. You see the difference. Learning management system, one provider. Personal learning environment, many providers. The personal learning environment produces support for learners to set out their own learning resources, their own learning goals, to define their own learning, to create their own learning. It lets them gather materials in, it lets them produce learning materials, it lets them communicate with other people who are creating learning materials. There is no tool out there yet called the personal learning environment. And in a certain sense, it's not a software application, but rather an approach, a mindset, a way of looking at learning. The old way, you have one provider of learning and you consume. The new way of looking at learning is you have many providers of learning and you are one of those providers. What's important here is that the personal learning environment is not simply a better way of producing content, but it's also a better way to learn. The old way of learning, where you have a producer that pushes material out at you and that you just receive it, that's not as good a way to learn as a learning mechanism, an active type of learning, which consists of practice and reflection. If you're not doing things, if you're not working with the material, you're not learning as well. The personal learning environment lets you work with the material and thus improves your learning. Personal learning leads to a model of learning where to teach is to model and demonstrate, and to learn is to practice and reflect. And you know, we talk about teaching and learning as though they're two separate things, but in a personal learning environment, they become one and the same. Everybody models and demonstrates. Everybody practices and reflects. There is not the distinction that there used to be between teacher and learner. And so we see the model of the personal learning environment where we have modeling and demonstrating, practicing and reflecting. These are the things that your tools allow you to do. And then that model gives you choice. It helps you develop your identity within the system, and most importantly, it fosters creativity. Now, I think I'm going to stop this show here because I think we've brought ourselves to the concept of the personal learning environment, and this will give you something to look forward to on Wednesday. I'm going to talk a bit more about the personal learning environment, a bit more about the features of it, some of the technology behind it, and to explain why Web 2.0 and personal learning environments are so important for the study of open educational resources and open courseware. So I really thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to discuss any comments or questions or anything else like that after this talk. So thank you very much, and I'll see you next time.